And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Monday, January the 23rd, 2017, 1:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I've got to apologize because since we went over into the new year, somebody wrote me a note saying that half the time I'm saying 2016 and half the time I'm saying 2017. Now, I know I said 2017 moments ago, but who knows how many times I've said 2016, so bear with me. It's like writing in my checkbook 2016 for the first month. You got to give me at least a month and a half to get all the 2016s out of the way. But it is 2017, and I am Scott Spears, and this is the Now program. And this hour, we wanted to invite a lady on who's always so very kind to us. She was on last week during President Obama's last press conference, and we're so glad she's able to come back so quickly because, frankly, last weekend might have been Friday, Saturday, Sunday, one of the most news-driven, big news story weekends in the history of Washington in a long, long time. And to get her take on that and on so many things that happened over the weekend will be a lot of fun. She was a panelist on the McLaughlin Group for many years, one of my favorite television series, and she is currently an author and reporter for The Daily Beast. She is Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm watching the TV coverage of the first briefing, press briefing in the Trump White House, and I'm glad I'm not smushed into the Brady briefing room with all the reporters anxious to see whether the new press secretary is going to walk back some of his comments from over the weekend. So every day brings a new twist and turn in this new administration. It's fascinating.
Now, Eleanor, correct me if I'm wrong here. I mean, obviously, we had a very busy campaign. Obviously, we had a very interesting transition time. But have you ever seen, and you've seen a lot more than I have you ever seen a three-day period like this past weekend, news-wise?
No, because, again, it was neck-wrenching from, you know, one set of attitudes and victories, you could say, to a diametrically opposed set of events and then back and forth. I mean, this really is a roller coaster ride with this new administration and the opposition that is building toward it. I thought the inauguration, the new president was true to himself. He sounded all the themes of his campaign. And if you supported him, I think you probably found it inspirational. If you opposed him, you got a sense of what the next months and years are going to be like with a president who's constantly relitigating his victory and the personality of Mr. Trump and how it's going to dominate everything he does. And then the Saturday showing of the marches in Washington, we had 500,000 people here, and then in other cities and around the world, I think really shows the energy, the potential energy behind an opposition movement that could build very quickly to this new president. And then Sunday, President Trump's appearance before the CIA and how he relished in the number of times he appeared on Time magazine's cover and basically sounded the warning that they were going to push back against the press and the back and forth over the crowd size and the new phrase that's been introduced, alternative facts. So that all happened over a three-day period. And today could be a time for the new administration to be doing a little self-correcting, or maybe not, maybe doubling down on the course they appear to have chosen. So he is, as always, setting the agenda.
Now, Eleanor, you're very unique to us here, perspective-wise, in Ohio, not just because of your great years as a reporter, but you live in Washington. That is your town. And it was certainly the mecca on Friday and Saturday last week for things happening. Even though a lot of protests went on a lot of other places, Washington was the place, D.C. Let's start with Friday. What was the tenor of the town during his inauguration, and did he accomplish anything in his speech? Somebody said to me Friday, has somebody told Donald Trump he's not running for office anymore?
Right. He's like a sore winner. He can't get over winning. It's bizarre. Well, the tenor of the town, Washington itself, there weren't too many Trump votes here in the district. And I had a car take me downtown that morning, and the driver said that he had driven during both Obama administrations and also the previous George W. Bush administrations. And he said, this one, he said, is like a high school prom or graduation. The numbers were visibly smaller. The metro moved very quickly. And so it was obvious that the energy wasn't here. But in fairness, Trump wasn't going to draw people from the immediate states around here. The Democrats carried Maryland and Virginia as well. His people really did have to come in from out of town. And, you know, they resemble the tourists that we see every spring when schools are out, and they come from all over the country. And they were noticeably white. But, you know, this is the character of the Trump administration's appeal. And I don't think it really detracted from the joy that people had watching the peaceful transfer of power and the joy that people had who supported Donald Trump. You know, obviously, people who oppose him are alarmed by the way he seems to make decisions and his determination to move ahead with dismantling the Affordable Care Act without giving a lot of thought to what will replace it. And people are waiting, what will he do on immigration and on trade? He's carrying through some of his promises already. So I think on Friday, you had at least two Washingtons. You had the people who came in and who were really supportive of his campaign and his presidency, the people who live here, who basically stayed away, and then official Washington that was on that podium with him, who he basically served notice that he is uprooting the elites in both parties. Now, having said all that, you look at the people he's putting into position, and they're the elites. They're not the ones who normally do the uprooting. So we'll see what happens if he can carry out all of his promises.
I think all of us in the news media have expressed our disbelief that this is what we're talking about, crowd size. But what the president talks about, he has a bully pulpit, and when you make such a big deal of it, as he did over the weekend, it's what you talk about. So just for the record, you were there. Compared to both Obama inaugurations and both Bush inaugurations, where did this one fit?
It was demonstrably smaller than both Obama administrations, and I'd have to go back and check with the records to see how it compared with the two Bush inaugurations. But it was not the biggest crowd ever to watch a presidential inauguration, as Sean Spicer claimed in his briefing. Now, if he had qualified that by saying, you know, people were watching it on YouTube and Facebook, and, you know, whether they have a way to measure how many people were watching it on social media, maybe he could have made his case that this was the most watched inauguration ever, especially if he threw in around the world. A lot of nervous people in capitals around the world. But he didn't qualify that. He basically, you know, compared it to people on the ground and then went through this sort of bizarre comparison that it's the first time that you had a tarp protecting the grass and so you couldn't really see the people. And, you know, it is a ridiculous topic to talk about. And I think it was clear that Mr. Trump was probably behind the assertiveness that Sean Spicer displayed. And so there's all kinds of speculation about whether Spicer really wanted to go out and say that or whether he was ordered to. But a press secretary's credibility is really important. And he squandered it on the very first day. So let's see if he tries to recover it.
Eleanor, before I get to the speech itself, a thought came to me about this whole crowd size thing. Now, Donald Trump, Sean Spicer, and everybody who was there with him when he was making these speeches and decisions about crowd size, Donald Trump, had to know this is the age where everybody has a smartphone. There were helicopters there that day. Cameras were being taken. Official photographers. That no matter what he said, the truth was the truth. Now, he might not say the truth about the crowd size, but he knows the truth. Was that a diversion?
Well, you know, the truth about crowd size has been fuzzy in the past. The National Park Service stopped issuing crowd numbers because they got so much blowback, and they stopped a number of years ago. But, you know, I take your point that they have to know that there was no way that this crowd was going to match the crowd that came for Obama in 2009. So if it's a diversion, what is it a diversion from? Excuse me, I have a cold. I guess from the Russian connection. I guess that's the major story that's bubbling along here. Wall Street Journal said that the FBI is looking at connections between General Flynn, who's the new National Security Advisor, and Russians, oligarchs, emissaries of the government. I do think that these investigations are going to poke along, and you know, there could be something really damaging to emerge at some point. I think we just don't know that, but I think there's a lot of resentment on the Democratic side that the FBI was looking at these connections during the campaign, and somehow that didn't leak, and yet they went sort of full frontal on Hillary Clinton and her emails. So it seemed like it was, you know, putting a finger on the scale in the election. And so that is still playing out. You have John McCain, who's one of the last cold warriors in the U.S. Senate, and he's very much on top of this issue. And you do have hearings that will get underway at some point. So I guess in the end it will all out, maybe, but it is a cloud over this administration as it takes office.
And as if there was not enough investigation starting for the current president, as of this morning, a liberal watchdog group plans to file a lawsuit, which they did this morning, contending that President Trump is violating the Constitution by continuing to accept payments from foreign governments at the business operated by his family. And this is a quote from them. It was our hope that President Trump would take the necessary steps to avoid violating the Constitution before he took office, said Noah Brookbinder, the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CRU. He did not. His constitutional violations are immediate and serious, so we were forced to take legal action. At issue is the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which bans payments or gifts from foreign governments. The lawsuit, which was filed in New York, seeks to stop Trump from taking payments from foreign governments. Cruz lawyers in the case include prominent constitutional law professor Lawrence Tribe, along with Norman Elson and Richard Painter, who served as top White House ethics lawyers for President Obama and President George W. Bush, respectively. So these are not politically biased people. They serve for Obama and for W. Bush. The lawsuit was filed this morning. This is a whole new lawsuit on top of all the Russian findings and sexual harassment suits and everything else. Is this one holding more weight? Is this more provable, Eleanor?
It's not a frivolous lawsuit, but at his press conference before he took office, the one in New York, where he had his lawyer go on at great length about how he was handling his family businesses, she made a point of saying that the emoluments clause should not be interpreted to cover the simple payment for a hotel room, I think is how she put it. So they've got their legal strategy or their legal defense. I think let's see if this holds up in the courts. I think it's legitimate to bring it, and I think it's also notable that Mr. Trump has said that he will not release his tax returns. There was no mention about the audit still continuing, which was what he used to cite always during the campaign. He basically said, I'm not releasing them. The American people don't care about it. Polls show that 75% of the public thinks that they should be released. Kellyanne Conway, the strategist, the highest placed woman in the White House, basically confirmed that in remarks over the weekend, too, that forget about those tax returns, we're never going to see them. So I think these are stories that have legs. I think you have investigative reporters at major outlets pulling all these strings and seeing what they can come up with. And then you have Trump administration basically casting the mainstream media as an enemy, trying to undermine the legitimacy of this presidency, and using various events like the Time magazine reporters' false report that they had taken the MLK Jr. bust out of the Oval Office, for which the Time reporter apologized repeatedly. Sean Spicer and the other administration spokesmen are basically using that as an example of the bad motives of the media. And so the whole discrediting of the media seems to be preparation to undermine any negative stories that might come out about Trump and the relationships with Vladimir Putin and whatever. I mean, more serious stories could be on their way. And so discrediting the media as a biased, uninformed, instrument of the left is all part of the strategy of this administration. And it's a familiar one that conservatives use. You can go back to the Nixon presidency and how they handled the media. In the end, though, the truth will out, but it may take a while.
The difference with Nixon, I think, is this. President Obama left office on Friday with a 60% approval rating. Donald Trump currently has a 37% approval rating. You and I, Eleanor, along with everybody else, has a 17% approval rating. If only 17% of... let's say that goes around the board. 17% of people listening right now believe what you and I say, even though they can't discredit it. How did we get there? How did we get to 17%?
Well, I don't remember a time when the media had a high approval rating, except maybe after Watergate, when the media was proved right in going after Richard Nixon. But during that whole period, there were times when the Washington Post was tempted to pull the plug on the investigation because so much opposition to it, and people didn't really seem to believe that a president could do those kinds of things. Then the conservative media was born, I think, really in the mid-90s. Remember, the Republican Congress swore in Michael Reagan and Rush Limbaugh as honorary members because their work on the radio had done so much to rally voters to the Republican cause, you know, giving them control of the House for the first time in like 40 years. So when Trump rails against the media, he's railing against the legacy media and some of the new outlets as well. But he comes to the White House with a whole infrastructure of his own in the media world. And so it's different from the past. The media now is quite fractured. And Trump can, I think one of the things they want to do is sort of pit media outlets against each other. But in the end, the goal is to have voters skeptical enough of anything they read from the mainstream media that somehow the White House voice will carry more weight than anything the media says.
That being said, and the topic of touching on the taxes brought a very interesting story late last night. After WikiLeaks spent most of the election focusing on revealing Hillary's emails and her constituents, the organization has taken a sudden interest in the guy who now sits in the Oval Office. On Sunday, the Julian Assange-led organization invited its followers to leak Trump's tax returns to them, which Kellyanne Conway confirmed the administration would not release the documents on ABC's This Week. Now, just for the record, she did say that on This Week. She said something similar on Meet the Press. Later on in the day, she went back to correcting herself and said they're still under audit and we don't actually know. We still might release them. That was the tenor of later on last night. But WikiLeaks is after them now. Now, Eleanor, the interesting question is do you think they'll get them? And if they do, should we pay attention because it's WikiLeaks?
Well, whether we should or we shouldn't, if anything comes out labeled Donald Trump's tax returns, that's going to get a lot of attention. I would hope there would be also an effort to make sure that they're valid and not phony. But, you know, and I think there will be the obligatory nods to the fact that we really shouldn't be paying attention to these leaks, which may have been engineered by the Russians, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, that didn't gain much traction during the campaign. And I just don't see media having the kind of self-restraint that they would ignore those kind of leaks if they came their way.
We learned in the election, certainly, that if nobody else can get it, even the New York Times, WikiLeaks did get some information on Hillary Clinton. Now, where did they get it? We now think they got it from Russia. But if you were a betting person, do you think they'll get his returns?
I actually have been amazed that they haven't come out because usually everything in Washington leaks. And the IRS is a particular agency, and presidents have been very wary of having the agency appear political after what we saw with Nixon. And the Obama administration really tiptoed around all of those investigations of conservative groups and their tax deductions. And in the end, all those conservative groups got their tax deductions. But, you know, in the end, I think there's got to be someone somewhere in that bureaucracy who will step forward. And whether they will do it surreptitiously or whether they will claim whistleblower status, I think either of those things could happen.
Here's the thing in my mind about these tax returns. If he had released them during the Republican primary when Ted Cruz called on him to do it, what I'm about to say would not have happened. The man is now a sitting president. We have not seen them. He's going to be under investigation. Well, he is under, well, the lawsuit's been filed, let's put it that way, about the Emoluments Clause. And he's going to be under investigation in the Senate and the House, and the Senate and the House will have subpoena power on his Russian ties. Now, if his tax returns do leak now, not only could they confirm his emoluments clause, but they could confirm that he does have links to Russia, which he has always said he did not have, this could really be big trouble if that comes out. Much more than just derailing a campaign. Big trouble now that he's a sitting president.
You know, I agree with you, but then you look for the next step. Where is the next step? It would be, you know, I hate, you know, 2 days into a presidency, talk about impeachment. It seems bizarre. But impeachment process would have to start in the House, and a Republican-controlled House would be really loath to turn on itself so early in a presidency. It could come through the courts. Jeff Sessions would be the attorney general. Would he recuse himself? Would he allow this to go forward? I'm not sure how it develops, but, you know, there's something there, and, you know, maybe it will all come to naught, but I think, again, this administration starts out with this kind of Watergate-type problem just bubbling up from within, and it's disturbing, and you don't really want this president to fail, and you don't really want him reacting to this kind of news. I mean, he can't handle the fact that his inauguration crowd is smaller than the previous president. You know, how would he handle something of this magnitude?
Eleanor, I want to get to the speech, and I do want to get to Sean Spicer and get your thoughts on the march. But this is something I've been asked so many times since the election. I want to know what your opinion is on this. And again, you're right. Talking about impeachment 3 days into a presidency is ridiculous, crazy to even think that we're doing that. But this is unconventional, as everybody has said. If it did happen, if the tax returns are leaked, and it shows that he had ties to Russia, and it shows that he knew what was going on with the hacking against Hillary Clinton, and the impeachment were to happen. Now, does that make Mike Pence the president, or because of the extraordinary nature of what happened, the fact that they hacked an election, does that make Hillary Clinton the president?
The hacking would not be into the actual vote casting. So I don't see how you could turn around and give it to Hillary Clinton, even though she won many more popular votes. And if Mike Pence emerged squeaky clean, ignorant of and not involved, ignorant of all this maneuvering and not involved, I would assume the presidency would fall to him. It's still hard to actually connect the dots to the Republicans actually sanctioning the impeachment process to begin. I still can't get my head around that. So,
yeah, well,
and I think, you know, the administration would respond. The American people knew all this, and they voted for him. End of story. I think they would just double down.
Want to go back to the speech. The inauguration speech was greeted, interestingly, by the media. George Will, a longtime Republican columnist, loved Ronald Reagan, loved pretty much the Bushes for most of what they did, called Donald Trump's speech the worst inauguration speech in the history of inauguration speeches, and Chris Matthews on MSNBC said that it had, and this is his quote, not mine, a Hitlerian background. What do you feel on those two quotes?
Yeah, they go further than I would, and even though that comes from the left and the right, I thought, I think I said as we first started talking, that he was true to himself in that speech. He raised all the points that he had raised during the campaign. I think, you know, the phrase American carnage was way over the top, but that fits into the stereotype that his supporters have of people who are not like them. The America First theme, I doubt that there are many Americans who know the kind of sordid history of those words that go back, you know, to the 1930s and early 40s and carry this taint of anti-Semitism with them. but you know, it was an inspirational speech for people who support him. And I you know, the few grace notes that we all, you know, bleed red when we're on the battlefield, and that if you're introduced to patriotism somehow, then there's no room for racial prejudice. I'm not quite sure how that connects, but maybe it does. I mean, he tried to inject a few grace notes, but I'm not sure people who are opposed to him are even willing to hear that from him. So, I think it was a blessedly short speech, and he sounded the themes that won him the presidency. And he's not going to back away from those themes, and he's acting on them right away.
Friday gave to Saturday, and Los Angeles, Washington, New York, Seattle, and a lot of other, Chicago, a lot of other places I'm leaving out, overseas, Mexico, United Kingdom. The protests happened. The Women's March happened. 2.9 million is an estimate I saw worldwide. Did it mean anything, Eleanor? What was it like in Washington? You were there Friday. What was it like in Washington on Saturday? And does it mean anything for the Democrats?
It was a joyous day. I mean, I granted everybody there probably was not a fan of Donald Trump, but it was not a mean-spirited event. It was very diverse in terms of, you know, age and ethnicity, and there were a lot of men. It was actually an uplifting event, and I think it told Democrats that this is not a lonely loss, that there are a lot of them out there, and that if they can somehow rally themselves, that there is a fight ahead that they can potentially win. And so I think harnessing that energy and making sure that it wasn't just a one-day event is where Democrats are now thinking. And if they could borrow a page from Grover Norquist, who was the Reagan official who organized these meetings of a whole assortment of conservative groups around one goal, which was no new taxes, and was able to really rally a whole bunch of conservative groups with different agendas around one goal. I think that's what Democrats now are going to try to do, is to get, you know, Planned Parenthood of the world, the Organizing for America, the Priority Action groups, all of them singing from the same page and understanding that they need to have a grassroots presence in every state in the country, and they have to start organizing like now, and that if they do, you know, they're not going to necessarily take back the White House in 4 years. They're not necessarily going to take back the Congress, but they got to build a long-term presence in the country that they have allowed to erode around the sort of the magic of the Obama presidency. And now that he's gone, you know, Democrats are really stranded and, you know, have to kind of start building anew a whole party infrastructure.
Eleanor, you're there in Washington. We've all been watching these confirmation hearings, talk of Rubio and McCain, because the Democrats will need votes to block anybody. Rubio and McCain possibly helping to block Tillerson, the DeVos, the I think that's right, the education secretary did not have a pleasant time last week during her hearing with Al Franken, certainly to be one, and Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders to be others. Who's going to get confirmed? Who's not going to get confirmed?
You know, you mentioned Marco Rubio and Tillerson. Senator Rubio put out a statement this morning that he's going to be voting for Tillerson. So he did a little display before the cameras, but in the end, he's stuck with his fellow Republicans. If the Republicans stick together, every one of these nominees can get through. I do think that Congressman Price is problematical because of the charges of possible insider trading, where his broker bought all these stocks, you know, immediately after he, Price, introduced a piece of legislation that would help them. I think, interestingly enough, the Treasury Secretary could run into some problems because he seemed to profit from the global downturn to an unusual degree. Maybe some Republicans might defect there. So I think Mnuchin and Price are the two possible ones. But again, if the Republicans stick together, they've got the votes, and they can confirm every one of these people.
In these hearings, which the Democrats, I think it's there's some show there. Obviously, they disagree, but I think there's some show from some of these senators because it's getting very rough, and they know they don't have the votes. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Al Franken. On Saturday, I saw an interview where Cory Booker said he will not run for president in 2020. Can you believe the day after the inauguration somebody asked him that? But, you know, that could change. But the young blood in the Democratic Party is very difficult to look at right now. Now, in 4 years, who knows? But Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Al Franken, they're getting the TV time. Are any of them in it, do you think? Al Franken. You know, we like show business now in our presidents.
That would be fascinating. He spent so many years basically not doing very many interviews and keeping a low profile because he wanted to be taken seriously after his career as a comedian on Saturday Night Live, that he has really emerged suddenly around the issue of Trump. Would Al Franken be a potential presidential candidate? You know, hey, we got 4 years. he can get both more serious and more funny over the next 4 years. So I think he's a possibility, and I think you mentioned Cory Booker as well. I mean, maybe he took himself out for 20 minutes, but I think he's in it. I think the new senator from California, Kamala Harris, is really presidential material. And could she do an Obama? I mean, Obama was only in the Senate for 2 minutes before he ran for president. So I think, yes, I think there are a number of Democrats, including a number of women, female Democrats, who are going to step up and be seen as potential candidates. But the organizing has to begin and has to be around some ideas, some strong economic proposals, and then around some candidates so that the Democrats, Democratic voters out there, can sort of set their sights on someone and something other than Donald Trump.
Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I say, well, she would be older in 4 years, but she'd still be younger than Donald Trump. So, in fact, Hillary would be younger than Donald Trump in 4 years. I've always thought that Elizabeth Warren was happy sticking to her lane, which was all about the banks and holding people accountable for the financial collapse. But I think Donald Trump has a way of changing people's minds about what they might be capable of. So, I mean, I think you have to view her as a potential candidate. Would Bernie do it again? I think that's a bit of a stretch, but, you know, who knows? I mean, now he would be older than Trump.
Well, you know, Eleanor
would be the only one.
Well, Eleanor, you know what's interesting? Obviously, the only big main stage Democrat right now who has huge name recognition, who is not going to run next time, obviously is President Obama, and the other, you know, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. But of course, all of that would be absurd. But the three who are there that everybody says, no dice, I just can't say it yet. No problem. The three are, because I think they all have reason. And I think it's how the next 4 years play out. And the three, one was Bernie Sanders. Even though he'll be older, he does feel he led a revolution. And when Chris Cuomo asked him on the town hall on CNN if he would do it, he didn't say no. He didn't do Cory Booker. He said, we'll see. We've got other things to worry about right now. Joe Biden says no, but he's got political ambition, and he's older than Trump. But Joe Biden, I believe, was going to be Secretary of State if Hillary got in. That's just what I was hearing and what I believed. I don't.
Well, she publicly asked him, and he publicly said no. But then the
what
election happened.
That's right. When it comes afterward, you never know. But right. I don't think he's ready for the rocking chair. And most people believe the reason he didn't run was because of the death of his son. Four right. years later, sitting in. Sitting home, will he be ready to jump in? I wouldn't rule it out. And then there is, you know, everybody says no, no, no. But if the Russian thing proves true, Hillary Clinton is younger than Trump, younger than Bernie, younger than Joe Biden, and she has tremendous ambition, and she tweeted out during that march on Saturday, tweeted out her campaign message, Stronger Together, and mm-hmm. she showed up at the inauguration. I don't know if Hillary's done. I just am, I can't say yeah. that yet.
You know, I think leaving the door open makes you more viable as a spokesperson, as a political figure. I just don't see Hillary Clinton doing it a third time. I know Reagan did it a third time, and it worked for him. I think it's unlikely. And I feel the same way about Joe Biden, but I think he has every reason to want to keep the door open to a potential candidacy because it just keeps him more relevant in terms of the foreign policy issues he cares about, the Cancer Institute that he will be founding here in Washington. So he may not run for president in 4 years, but we will still have him to kick around, I guess, for 4 years. He's definitely going to be very much in the mix.
If Hillary, I don't think I've ever asked you this, Eleanor, if Hillary took Bernie as her vice president, would she have won?
You know, in retrospect, those Bernie voters who didn't show up, they were part of the demographic that elected Barack Obama twice, and they didn't show up in the numbers that were needed. So in retrospect, that would have been a campaign choice if she had picked Sanders. She went with a governing choice, someone who she would feel comfortable with working side by side for 4 years. Tim Kaine would have been to Hillary Clinton, like Joe Biden has been to Barack Obama. But if she'd made a governing choice, him or even one of the Castro brothers might have energized the Hispanic vote more. Yeah, I think she took it for granted that she was going to win. And so she didn't do the big, bold decisions in terms of picking her vice president or putting forth policy proposals. She didn't want to make any promises she didn't think she could fulfill because it looked so much in the bag that she was going to win. Now we all realize that's not the case, and the cracks in the facade were there for anyone if they bothered to look. But you know, I do take that your premise there that if Bernie Sanders ticket, we might have had a different outcome.
Final question. I want to slip this in really quick. The piece of footage that was not shown as much as every other piece of footage on Friday was Donald Trump at the dinner following the inauguration, one of the first dinners. Hillary and Bill were there. I think it was the only time they were in the same room that day. And he made it a point, not Jimmy Carter, not the Bushes, who were also there, made it a point to say, recognize Hillary and Bill Clinton, had them stand up, and said how much he respected them. Was that were you surprised
by
that?
Yes, I think that was at the lunch immediately after the inauguration. And I suspect that somebody said to him, look, in your inaugural address, you said some nice things about President Obama and the smooth transition, but past presidents have also saluted their opponent. And with Hillary Clinton there, that would have been a nice thing to do. You didn't do it. Here's a chance to make up for that. Because he did, that was a very gracious thing he said, and he had them both stand up and said how much it meant to him that they were there, and said, these are two, what else can I say? These are two people who I have great respect for. So that was nice, but it did not make the headlines. You're right. But that was fulfilling what any gracious winner should have done from the inaugural platform, actually.
And the long ball here, Eleanor, with 2 minutes, we all know what Sean Spicer did on Saturday. And if you don't, the quick synopsis is, came out, gave facts that were not exactly true pertaining to the inauguration size. Kellyanne Conway, Meet the Press, yesterday morning, introduces us to the new word, alternate, new words, alternate facts.
Right.
What does that mean to you?
And Chuck Todd, the NBC host, his expression on his face was priceless when he said alternate facts are not facts, they're falsehoods. And she got kind of huffy. She said, if you're going to talk about our press secretary like this, we're going to have to redefine our relationship, which, again, shows administration that's clearly willing to crack down on individual reporters if they can.
Eleanor, it was very easy to eat up 50 minutes today with the weekend we had, and I always thank you for coming on, because that was a great take, especially from somebody who has a background and experience like you. Thank you so much, Eleanor.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Eleanor Cliff, the Daily Beast. We can probably get one phone call in if you want to comment on anything that happened over the weekend or what we just heard from Eleanor Cliff. 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. We will have open phone lines on this program other days this week, so don't miss that. And we're getting a phone call, so apparently somebody wanted to say something. Go ahead. Go ahead, caller. Oh, maybe not. Okay, if that was you, give us a call back. We're hanging on here for the one phone call. We got a phone call, though, but I don't know where that one took off to. But if you have something you want to say, this is your time to say it in regard to the Eleanor Clift interview or anything that happened over the weekend. Give your take or agree with Eleanor. 740-383-9944. And again, the rest of the week, we will have other things going on. You are live on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I just think to me we just need to put this bypass with us with the Trump. He's the president, and we all need to support our president and all the backflashing that you're hearing about. You know, if the one lady said the Washington, D.C., she was talking about the peaceful. I seen where clips where people that were going into the some of the buildings, people are throwing water on them and stuff like that. I mean, that's just a bunch of baloney. And like I said, people need to get real and realize that Trump's the president, and support, whether you like it or not, that's just the facts.
Well, no, you definitely protest peacefully, and anybody who threw water or did anything like that is certainly not condoned by this program or Eleanor Clift or anybody else. But I think the problem once again is, and we did this last week, we were very fair to Trump on Friday. We said, this is his day, give it to him. But you also have to do that. There were 2.9 million protesters, and if 300 of them were conducted in an conducted themselves inappropriately, it certainly does not represent the 2.9 million that protested. And some people are saying those numbers are the biggest protest that has ever happened in the history of the United States. So to not count it or pretend like it didn't happen or didn't mean anything, I also think would be a grave injustice.
No, I agree with you on that. And the other thing is, I agree with what she said. One thing is the fact that the Russians didn't vote for the presidency. We as Americans did, and we clearly voted for Trump.
Three million more Americans voted for Hillary, but yes, he did win the Electoral College.
That's all that matters to me. He won more in the states than she won.
That is true. Thank you, sir. And that is all the time we have. We will talk to you tomorrow, but for this day on... What an interesting conversation. Hope we can continue it tomorrow. On this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout. Take care. Make it a great Monday. Center Street here in Marion. Telephone number 740